Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode. Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members. I have my plus one plunger, a steaming hot cup of holy water, blessed by St. Keurig, and I have a very special union member with me today to help plunge the dungeon and flush evil down the drain. Our guest today is the host of the YouTube channel Bandits Keep, co-host of the Monsters and Treasures podcast, along with K.R. King of D&D Homebrew. Welcome to the show, Daniel Norton.
Thank you. Happy to be here. It's my turn to come in, so, you know, getting over time. Night shift.
I really appreciate it, man. It's I've been a longtime listener of yours. I love the rapport that you and KR have with each other, and I find your whole approach to old school gaming is really palatable to me, and I find like how you approach it is like the way that I would do it. I don't feel like you're like a hardcore, like, oh, this is the one true way to play the game. So you're all right about like making it your own and having fun and stuff. So
yeah, definitely. You know, it's funny, I don't think I've ever said this anyway, you get exclusive. I was just thinking, you know, so KR, you know, of course has a YouTube channel as well. And I don't remember exactly what happened. One of us commented on the other's video, and then somehow we were just like, hey, you want to chat or whatever? And we were just, we literally called each other old. So you can't see us, we're old people. And we're like, we ended up on the phone, right? Like of all things, right? Like none of this, like, you know, whatever kids are using these days. And we talked for like 2.5 hours, like literally, like just we first time we ever talked. And I literally said to him, and the next time I talked to him, I said, we should just make a podcast. It's just that. Because we like talked about everything. We were talking all over the place. And he was like, really? And I was like, yeah, let's give it a shot. And that's how we got our kind of intro thing that we say. We talk a lot about something. We only give you the best parts because that's literally the first few times we just recorded us talking and then went back. And I say we went back, but KR went back and edited it and found the podcast in that. Now we do it a little bit more in an organized fashion, but still a little haphazard. But yeah, it's like sometimes you just find somebody you click with and you're just, you know, there. I don't know, there you go. Random story of about Monster and Treasure. Bonus.
I always wondered about that, about whether or not that was an actual saying or if that was something that you guys actually did. Like, how much recording do you guys do before and how much stuff gets cut off in that podcast?
So the way we do it now generally is we'll get together. We have a set time. Once a week, we get together for a couple hours. And we'll just look at a list that we've kind of been compiling, and we compile it as we go. Whenever you hear us say, that's a podcast topic, we put it in a list. And then we'll be like, what do you want to talk about today? And then we'll just start talking about our games that week, whatever, whatever. And then one of us will be like, oh, that's probably a topic. And then we'll just hit record and we'll try to record that part of it. And then we'll stop and go, oh, okay, that was good. And then we'll start talking again, and then we'll do it again. But sometimes we go sideways. And so sometimes we end up talking for 20 minutes and like not that much gets cut out. And then sometimes we talk for 45 minutes and, you know, 29 minutes of it gets cut out because we went totally sideways and didn't actually, you know, hit the topic. So we do kind of do that a little bit, but it's a lot more organized than it used to be. Kara always tells me that he's got all this like hours and hours of like stuff that are like possible podcasts that he has to go back through and reassemble someday. But I don't think we'll ever see those.
Wow. The uncut files.
That's what I said. I was like, oh, this could be something special. We'll release it on like special Blu-ray.
that would be awesome. So you don't need to go too into depth, but I do have some listeners that might not be aware of who you are. So if you could just give us like maybe a little bit about your, how did you get into the gaming, and then, you know, where, how you arrived at where you are now.
So when we were kids, you know, at somehow, you know, I got Basic Dungeons and Dragons, Moldvay Basic. This was like 1981. Played until I was like maybe in high school at some point, stopped playing. And then sometime around 2015-ish, I was working with these guys and one of them said, hey, you guys want to get there and play D&D? And literally what came out of my mouth was, they still make that game? because I had lost all contact with it. I didn't really. At some point in the 90s, I was interested again, and all my books had been given away. And I went and like bought the second edition, which I didn't even realize was a second edition because I didn't remember, you know, and I didn't play it. I kind of bought it and then forgot about it. So that's also kind of weird. But then I got back in hardcore with 5e, and I played for you know, ever since. And the channel really got started because a bunch of us back in the Google Plus, I was at the very end of the Google Plus days, so I'm not like a cool blogger Google Plus person, but used to be able to record directly to YouTube from Google Plus. There was like a Google Meets is what they called it. So we all played on that, and people would be like, oh, you guys are playing tomorrow. I can't play. Could you record it? So everybody had a YouTube channel, and we would just literally just record ourselves. It wasn't an actual play, like a Critical Role or something where we're really doing a long-term campaign or like a really, you know, obviously production value not very good. You know, kids are yelling in the background. People are getting up in the middle and getting pizza, you know, but it was just everybody recording their own games. And then one day I just was like, I had something I want to talk about. I can't remember what the first video was. I should probably go back and look. And I just had an idea I wanted to talk about. And I was like, I'm just going to sit down and record a video where I just talk about a concept or whatever. And I did that, and it got like a bunch of views, like way more. I was getting like, you know, 15 views on the video, right? Because it was my friends. And all of a sudden, like 200 people watched this video. And I was like, oh, maybe people are interested in what I have to say. And then, you know, having a huge ego like I do, you know, I just continued, and I've been trying to do it ever since.
Do you remember some of the like the names of the people that you played with on Google Plus at that time? Because there was like, I remember James Malachevsky and Jeff Reince and some of these guys, like I remember hearing all the time, oh yeah, we played online, and I was like, I don't know, man, this sounds, I was too intimidated by that to get involved.
Yeah, no, I wasn't part of that cool group. No, but you know, mostly people, I was part of a thing called the One Shot Gamers, OSG. So it was called the One Shot Gamers Facebook group. And it was literally designed for, as you guessed it, one shots. And it was a really kind of a no BS kind of group where it was like, you went on there and you put a pitch. You were like, you are adventurers entering into a deep dungeon where goblins have taken over. Your goal is to get the gem of blah, blah, blah. Who wants to play this game? And then people would be like, interested, interested, interested. And when you had enough people, you'd make the game as a Facebook event and people would join and you were good. And like this group had like three or four games going like every single day. It was like packed, but there was like 2,000 people in the group. And it was, of course, it was very clicky because, you know, people start playing with people. So it was like hard to get into people's games. So it took me a while to actually get into any games online. But then once I started playing with those people, we used Google Plus. So I wasn't a part of I wasn't part of the cool blogger people, but we used the system. Yeah, too bad. I mean, I'd like to say that I was, but I was not. Dan's not cool.
When we were talking, you know, kind of like, you know, what could we talk about for you to come on the show? You had mentioned that you've been working on your own kind of a game system. So tell us a little bit about that. What was the sort of inspiration and what is this system? And before even that, I would say how many or what's, I guess it's a rite of passage, sort of like a Jedi. You got to create your own lightsaber. So you need to create your own system. Is that the sort of feeling that you're going with here?
So it's really interesting. I've always been pretty happy with systems that were out there. And I certainly wasn't trying to create something that was better than anything that had been before me. I mean, everybody, just like everybody, I house rule. I make my own changes, whatever. But I played a lot of BX, a lot of Lamentations of the Flame Princess was an early game that was like one of the early OSR games. Played a lot of Swords and Wizardry, you know, and I was quite happy with that. But what happened was my friend Tony, he was like, hey, you really like Conan, right? And because I was getting into reading the Conan novels, which I hadn't read them until, like, you know, this is like 2018 or something or whatever. I had never really actually read the novels. So I was just getting into it. I was reading them. And he's like, there's this, what's his name? It's Gray Elf. Jason Vey is his actual name. He had I think it's Gray Elf, if you Google it. He has a system a Conan system, that's a Conan OD&D system. And he sent me the link, and it's free. You can download the PDF or whatever. And in this system, he uses chainmail, or talks about using chainmail. So chainmail, for people who don't know, so let's roll back. So I'm playing, you know, Basic Expert, which is like 1981 or whatever. D&D, of course, came out in 1974. And in the original Three Little Brown Books, the original Dungeons and Dragons, it says use the combat system from chainmail. But if you don't have it, or if you want, use this, you know, alternative combat system, which is like one page of the book, and that's your D20 system that everybody plays today. Is that alternative system, right? Because people didn't play chainmail. So I had picked up OD&D, and I had picked up chainmail separately in my kind of quest to see what was happening, you know, the history like people do, and both of them seemed completely confusing to me, you know. And I was like, nah, I'm playing BX, it works. Then this fascinated the heck out of me, because when I looked through this thing, he talked about how chainmail uses different combat systems for different things. There's like an abstract combat system for like mass battles. There's a more specific detailed combat system that's weapons versus armor, really gritty. And then there's a fantasy combat system that's very, very simple. That's really like, doesn't take into account anything except for who you are. You're a hero or a superhero. They're a dragon, right? That's all that matters. And the, you know, in the system, I think they don't use the fantasy system, but he talks about it. And I was like, this might be the secret sauce, like, that I didn't even know I was looking for. The thing is that what I've found in my games is that things like, and you see people, like, you, there's a million YouTube videos, a million podcasts about how fixing hit points, fixing combat, fixing this, fixing that. And I really thought when I looked at this that this fixed it all, like, to me, like, fixed it as if it was broken. I mean, obviously, it's people have been playing 50 years. It wasn't broken, right? There was the idea that, like, you could get a fighter. Let's say you had a fourth level fighter. You could stand up to 8 or 10 or 12 men at arms or orcs like Conan does and actually have a chance of winning, because you're not really going to, in standard D&D, even if maximum hit points, you're not going to win that fight in the long term unless you're incredibly lucky. And even if you do, you're going to be so beat up that the next fight you have, you're dead. But by using, let's say, the abstract combat system, where a hero needs to be hit 4 times simultaneously in the same round to go down, but you attack 4 times in one round. When you're fighting 8 orcs, like, the chance of them actually hitting you 4 times in one round is pretty slim. And it's not impossible. The very first test I ever did, I did 4 orcs against a hero and they killed him in the first round, which was like amazing. And that was actually perfect too, because I was like, the dice still matter, right? You're not playing Superman. You can still die. But after that round of combat, or the 2 or 3 rounds of combat, where you kill those 12 orcs, if you are not dead, you're fine. And I thought, that's Conan, right? That's the stories I read. You see, that's a Bruce Lee movie, right? Where he's getting the crap kicked out of him. But when he fights that last bad guy, he's effectively fine, right? He collapses at the end. But like, that's like drama. And this system can do that. Fantasy combat basically does that, where fantasy combat doesn't take into account your weapons or armor. It's Conan tearing tearing the horn out of the demon god as it's rising with his bare hands, because he is a superhero. A regular person can't do that. A demon cannot be hit by a regular person, but a superhero can do it with their bare hands. So seeing this, it was super inspirational. I got super excited, just like I am now. and then, of course, detailed combat, which in the end, I don't use nearly as much as I'd like to, because it is really cool. But you know what? I'm making a choice. I'm starting with a lance or a spear to keep the enemy at bay. But when they come in closer, I'm switching to a sword or a mace, depending on what their armor is. That's also fun. And we've used it for duels and, you know, where you call out the orc leader. You know, it's like, if I beat you, I rule your tribe. You know, these combat systems all really felt awesome. And I'd love to say that if you just use chainmail with OD&D, it works perfectly. It doesn't. Those astute viewers on YouTube will see that I switched drinks. I've 2 drinks going on here.
Hey, no judgments on the Dungeon Plunger podcast.
We are two-fisted. So all of this is wonderful, but it doesn't actually really work perfectly in tune. And thus began me pulling apart OD&D, pulling apart chainmail, and seeing where they actually worked together and where they just didn't, where it didn't make sense, where things needed to be changed. And so I'll say, I appreciate this at the beginning, for anybody listening or watching that's going to already typing in a comment, this is not how people used to play. This is not the right way to play. This is definitely not how they played, right? This is me looking at these two systems and going, hey, they said to use chainmail, and maybe what they really meant was use it if you do a mass battle. To me, I'm saying, what if I sat there in 1974 with these 3 Little Brown Books and this war game, and I stuck them together? What would I get? And that's basically what my game is. And it didn't take that long to get it going. But this is the funny part about making a game. I've been running a campaign for over 3 years, and it works great. And sometimes we have to make little changes. But like, I haven't sat down to finish the thing because I'm just enjoying it. Because it was never my mission to make the next big thing, right? It was my mission to make the game that was as perfect as possible for me and my group. So this is not fixing. This is not better than. This is just a different way of looking at the game that we play that we really love. And I used to do a whole podcast that was basically me building it. And you can, if you're actually interested in that part of it, go back to that podcast. It still exists, where you see me like talking about these various things and like trying things and saying, oh, this isn't working. How can I do this? And asking people's advice and people calling in. And, you know, so in some ways it's the community, you know, on some level of the game, you know, things that they've suggested are coming to the game, my table, right? How we play. So I find it to be the right game for me, and very easy to teach. I think that people are intimidated by tables, and this game requires you to use tables. So there's no THACO, which people hate anyways. There's no attack bonus plus your level hit at 20 or whatever. You've got to look. I have a sword. They have chainmail armor. Let me look on a chart. How many dice am I rolling? And a lot of people will look at that and think that's going to be slow and clunky. But in fact, if you've ever played my game, it is super fast. Sometimes I think too fast.
Hmm. So before you kind of go further, I'm just sort of curious, like when you're playing your game, are you playing with the old school sensibilities of it's the player skill versus the game master's sort of ingenuity and what they put, or are you trying to like more emulate like or role play and be more your character and do what your character would do and be a part of that kind of action?
Yes. I'm not sure that's different. I think that, so in my general philosophy on gaming is that, you know, it's running a game, I should say, is that I like simpler systems because I don't feel that. And now this is one of the things why I agree with Kara a bunch about, you know, like the little semantics of it, of like, I don't think that it's possible to make rules for everything. So I think that in the end, you have to have a strong understanding of the world between you and the players, and you have to work together to figure out what logically would make sense in this situation, right? So in order to do that, you can't really be playing against the players. Not that you said that, but it can't really be like, aha, figure out my trap. It's got to be a little bit of, this is a world, this is a trap. What's logical? This is here. You want to do this. I'm explaining it to you. Should it work? Maybe not. Maybe it should. Let's roll dice. That being said, I'm not a voice person, you know, and my table doesn't generally. I mean, I wouldn't frown on if people did. But I do talk in character as a DM, and my players talk in character sometimes, you know, when it makes sense.
Right.
But we don't always. And I'm fine with like cross table talk. So I guess I'm a mixed style. Like I like it as it's a game, right?
Yeah.
It's not theater, you know, and nobody's watching us if we're playing, especially at my home table. So I think that I do appreciate player skill, and I think that's super important. And I want players to outsmart the world, but I'm not out to try to trick them. You know, I'm not out to like be smarter than them, because I'm not smarter than my players, not even by a little bit, you know, and in fact, I love when they just do something. I'm just like, what? Okay, fine. You did it. You know, it's like the ultimate. We were playing, God, it's a while ago now, but they had like, I mean, it took, and actually I was telling Kara this, I don't think we ever recorded this on the podcast. He was just like blown away by how long it took them to figure out what they were going to do when they were trying to get this guy, this big bad, if you will, this guy thereafter. And they took what probably he probably would have pulled his hair out based on what he's, although not really, because you know, we're all more extreme on the podcast than we are in person. And it took literally probably a month of sessions of them like talking, doing small things, moving their, you know, and then literally they executed and nearly flawlessly walked into this main bad guy, like somebody who's ruling an entire island with lots of guards, lots of magic, whatever. that they figured all, they did all the investigation, and they literally walked right in and executed him. I mean, he was evil. It's okay. And they when they did it, like the character snuck up, he rolled the die. He swung his, he's like, all right. I'm like, all right, we'll roll, you know, he's asleep, you know, cause you timed this right. You roll this. If you roll this or below, you walk up to him while he's still sleeping. They rolled. And again, I'm a roll, let them know what the roll is in front of them. And, they succeeded. And then he's like, why chop his head off? And I'm like, okay, his head is severed from his body and falls on the ground. And they just all waited for me to be like, no, you can't do that. But no, I mean, they did it. They had taken the time to figure it out, right? And because they did that, so that's your player skill, right? They thought about it. They did the research. They figured out what would work against this guy, who he really had working for him. Because, of course, I am definitely the person that will have people say things that aren't true, right? Like people are going to say, that, well, how do we, you know, kill this evil cleric? Well, you can't. He's got 37 demons that guard him at night, you know, because that's the rumors, right? So you have to do your research, take your time, figure out what's true, what's not true. And when they can do that, they're rewarded. And they love that, you know. Would it have been cool if there was a big epic fight with him and all his spells and magic arms stuff? Sure. But it was also just as cool to have 4 or 5 sessions of just planning, tinkering, stealthing, moving in, researching, to have that one moment where it was just done and over. And you know, and they were like, and they took his head, because they were like, if we take his head, they can't, well, in my world, there's no, well, there's reincarnate, which they weren't thinking that they would use, but that's a whole other story. So they're like, if we take his head, they can't raise him from the dead, because they knew that existed. So they stole the guy's head, and they were carrying this guy's head around, you know? So yeah, that's it. They're like, they can never bring him back because we have his head.
That's pretty awesome. So going back to where you were talking about, like, so you have these tables that you roll on. What are we talking here? Like, is this like a D20 type of roll, and then we're going to add, make some, you know, add to it, or how does that work?
The entire game is D6s. I do still use the OD&D books for like charts and stuff. So I will occasionally roll a D20 or a D10 for that. But all the rolls that are done are D6s. Basically, you would, for instance, like I'll say same versus same. So if you were like heavy foot, so let's say a sword versus, let's say, chainmail, and then we're talking about abstract combat where it doesn't matter, right? What exact weapon you're using, it's more a range of weapons. Those are equal. So that means that somebody needs to roll a D6 and get a 6 to have a hit, right? So equal versus equal is one die and a 6 is a hit. So if you are, let's say, a 5th level fighter and you're fighting against 5 figures, you will get 5 dice and any 6s will be hits, right? It for most creatures, their hit dice is how many times cumulatively they need to be hit in a combat. For special monsters and player characters, it's how many times in a single round. So there I'm taking the rule from chainmail, where a hero needs to be hit 4 times simultaneously. Now in my game, a 2nd level character that's 2 hit dice needs to be hit twice simultaneously to die. So now imagine you're a 2nd level fighter and you're in chainmail and you face off against an orc with a sword. He can't kill you because he's only rolling one die. You have now basically made the 2nd level fighter a true hero and not, oh God, an orc can still kill me with one hit if I'm unlucky. So again, so you see how that quickly jumps into the system. So, you know, but of course, if you have like better armor, then it might be like, okay, it takes one die per 2 figures. So if you were in plate mail, right, even if, as a 1st level fighter, it might take 2 orcs to roll one die. And if they get a 6, you'd be dead. Because yes, that is the answer to that. If you have one hit die and you get hit, then yes, you are dead. And people will say, that's really deadly. But if you, it's all based on averages. If you have the average hit points that you'd have at OD&D, which is half of a D6, and everything rolls a D6 as a damage, one hit on average will kill you. So it's really not unfair. It does take a little bit of extra like luck out that you might have, but it's basically, it's balanced in that way. The fantasy combat, which is a fantastical combat, those creatures often cannot be hit at all unless you are either a fantastical level, like a hero, or you have like a magic weapon, or like a mummy, for instance, is you can use fire. And if you do that, you roll on a different table, and it's a 2d6 roll, and you just roll once. That's it. But you do your damage and hit dice. So again, your 5th level fighter fighting that mummy rolls once. If they score a hit, they do 5 dice of damage. If a mummy has 5 hit dice, it's dead. If it's 6, it's not dead yet. You know, and that's basically how that works. So it's that part's pretty simple. The detailed combat gets more detailed. Like if you're going to do a detailed combat, now your fighter gets five effectively actions. And those could be parries, they could be attacks, etc. And they're going to roll 2d6 per attack, and each one will actually do hit points. So I still do use hit points. And the big difference here is that hit points linger. It takes 1 week of absolute rest, no adventuring, no traveling, no nothing, and you heal back all of your hit points. That's just how that works. And, or you don't heal back any, so they just linger, right? Or there's a heal wound spell, but it takes the cleric 24 hours to do it with you. Like it takes, you sit with 24 hours for them to heal you and you're healed completely, but it takes the cleric and that player character out of play for 24 hours to do it. So you can't do it in a dungeon. So hit points can be incredibly dangerous. So things like dragon's breath, oozes, poison, right, all do hit point damage. So that's your fighter's invulnerable because they're 5 hit dice. That's true, but the fighter still only has 18 hit points. And if they get hit by, let's say, a poison, it takes 10 hit points of damage, they're hurt, right? And they could still die. And we've seen that happen where people are really low hit points. But if you get into that Final Fantasy combat and you're a fighter and you've only got 4 hit points left, you still fight as a fantastical fighter. So you don't just go down the first time the mummy hits you, right? So this is kind of the balance. If you see how, I don't know if I'm explaining it properly. Like it creates this, it is a very heroic game. It's a heroic version of D&D. Like there's no question, this isn't designed to be Mudcore or realistic or whatever. This is designed to be the movies that I love to watch, the 80s sword and sorcery movies where the barbarian cuts through the guards like nothing, has a bunch of fights, gets beat up, is covered in wounds, and then still stands up and fights the main bad guy at the end and hopefully defeats them, right? Which really, without magical healing, isn't possible in D&D. Not really, you know? And that was always the thing I didn't love about trying to do that Conan-esque kind of thing with straight-up D&D. I still love just straight-up D&D, but when I'm trying to do that kind of game, that gritty kind of, in the dungeon, I'll run BX, right? But when I want to run my heroic or my sword and sorcery, then this is why I run my own system.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because when you're talking about healing, like it takes 24 hours to heal, to me that really sounds like that scene from Conan where they're on the beach. I think it's a beach, and and Mako is there and he's like, the spirits are coming to get him, and like that's awesome,
And exactly.
Especially,
and I love that you said that. Let me cut you off because I love to cut people off. I love that you said that, because that's exactly what to me is my answer when somebody will just look at the mechanic and go, oh, that doesn't make any sense, or that's dumb, or oh, you just put that in there for balance. I did actually put it in there for balance, but the story that you're telling is why.
Right, right. And I find it interesting also because I find so often when we have this discussion about old school role playing, and when we're talking about OD&D in particular, it is that like gritty, like boom, you're dead. Like you don't have any, the common sort of cry is as well, you're not heroes, right? You're just scumbags going to steal treasure from a crypt. And I'm like, yeah, but the fiction, right? Like exactly what you're saying with Conan and a lot of those, pulp fiction heroes, which supposedly are the appendix N of D&D, right? That's not really emulated in the game very well at that era anyway. So it's cool to see that you're like, nah, man, I want the heroics and I want to emulate Conan and that style of play. So I'm curious, when it comes to magic, so we've talked a little bit about like healing and stuff like that. How does it work for sorcery? Like, are you able to be a sorcerer and cast spells and stuff? Or do you have like some sort of dark and dangerous magic? How does it work?
That's a very good question. So I just use regular OD&D magic, but I stick to what, again, I believe I'm reading in the rules, which a lot of people do not do, which is that it says every spellcaster needs a spell book.
Right.
So that means you two clerics.
Oh,
it doesn't
really?
Tell you how many spells they start with. It doesn't say anything. So in my game, I have you roll a die, and that's how many spells you have in your book. Everything else you must research, find, trick, steal, whatever. So while we do still have the same standard spells, they're a little bit harder to get. So that it also gives a reason for money, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it also creates a situation where if I'd had somebody like really like get like just the way it was written, the comment was written, they seemed like they were very upset for my players. Because once I was talking about it, I think it was in the video where I was like, the players are chasing this quest that they want to go on, and they've leveled up and they don't have any spells for this new level that they could theoretically cast, but it will take them 2 months to learn a spell and they don't want to stop until they solve this thing. And the person in the comment was like, come on, man, just give them the spells. It's like, no, that's player choice, right? They could stop doing the thing they're doing for 2 months, or they could break into a wizard's tower and steal a spell book. I mean, they have all these options to get this spell. I'm not giving them anything. And when right. they get their spells, they are happy to have them, and they think about it, and it does create. So here's the thing, like spells in OD&D, especially, I'm talking like little brown books, are incredibly vague. As soon as Greyhawk comes out, you start getting some, as I say, nerfing to things immediately, right? I don't mean nerfing. Like, I'm just using the spells the way they are. Like Charm Person's crazy powerful. Sleep, I mean, these spells are super powerful. They don't get that many of them, you know? And a magic user has one hit die, and they can't wear armor. So they're light foot. So that same sword is hitting you on a 5 or a 6, right? So now a fighter's got a 33% chance if they walk up to that magic user with a sword to kill them in one hit, right? If they were in chainmail, the magic user can't even hit them back with their dagger, right? So a magic user is incredibly fragile. And because of that, so I'm going to go back to magic users, because really, I should say this, and you might get the sense of this. This game is almost like a love letter to fighters. Fighters are, because people say, and I don't know, I didn't know Gary Gygax. I didn't read Dragon Magazine as an adult really back then, so I don't know what people were saying. But it was always said that Gary thought that because they were like, Gary hates magic users, which I've heard that, but that doesn't make any sense because he played magic users, but whatever. But that he read books where fighters were the heroes, right? And I don't think that D&D ever really did that. You know, they're okay. It says right in OD&D, magic users are weak, fighters have to protect them. But there's no rules for it, right? So how does that work? So that's something I wanted to really put into this rule system. So for instance, if you had two fighters in chainmail and a magic user, and they work together as a cluster in abstract combat, they all defend as chainmail because it's an average. Now, if you, and this happened in my solo game, I had 5 magic users because people kept dying, and 2 fighters, and they got encircled. Well, now you've got 5 guys in no armor, 2 guys in armor. Guess what? Everybody counts as no armor because that's how the game plays, right? So there is that there. I think that magic users are a good option, and they're powerful as soon as they get going. But, you know, again, it's not, I don't do this like you lose hit points or whatever. I just don't feel like that's necessary in the game system. I mean, a lot of people probably do think it is, I guess. I think it can be necessary in your world. And you can add things to it to make it like that. People hate magic users. Don't cast spells around people, though. You know, it's really hard to get if you want to have components, which I'm not a fan of components because I'm a fan of fancy and magic. And in fancy and magic, they never use components.
Oh, really? Where did that come from then? The like adding components?
That's a good question. There is an article. I want to say that if you Google, there's a compilation somebody put out there called the OD&D Extras. And it's got a bunch of articles put together. And I think that's where I read it. And there's an article, it was either in Strategic Review, where I believe it was in Dragon, where Gary Gygax talks about the magic system and he talks about the components and stuff. And he kind of, I mean, the way I read it is he kind of says he did that to make it harder to people to cast spells. He was like, spells are too powerful. I want to make it more difficult. We're going to add this extra thing to it. I think that the idea was originally, it was just like you had a spell, you could cast it. You know, I mean, that's how it was in the Vance books. Nobody ever, you know, they memorize a spell, and then when they want to cast it, they just cast a spell. It's done. And that's how I like spells to be. And it does make them way more powerful. And sometimes I'm like, damn, magic's powerful when the players will use it against, you know, people. But then I also think, but it's super limited, you know? And the fact that they don't have every spell in the world, and I stick with, like, level caps on elves, so they can only go so far. So, yeah, it's not dark and dangerous. I kind of somewhat have written it into my game. I don't know if I truly will or not, but in my world, I just have one god as kind of the running thing. And so there's not that many clerics. And so they've got to pray and study and learn the spell. So my one cleric, when they want a spell, they have to like literally spend months to learn it because there's no one to teach it to them. They are the only cleric because this god is so sparse and stuff. I'm eventually going to change the spell lists, I think, because I want to remove things like protection from evil, for instance, from the magic user spell list to put that on clerics. Because I feel like some spells should be on one and not on the other. Because protection from evil, for instance, the way I run it is, if you are a wholly evil creature, wholly of chaos, you can't touch somebody who has a protection from evil spell on them. So a magic user steps into a room and there's, I don't know, a vampire, protection from evil. That vampire can't touch him. Now, the vampire could shoot a bow at them, I guess, or drop a rock on their head, but they themselves can't touch them, which makes it an incredibly powerful spell against things that are of chaos. Now, so that's the other thing. Not everything that's chaotic is blocked, but things that are true chaotic, which is things like a vampire, right? So there's that, you know, these are all things that are like are where we play at the table that aren't fully in the alpha yet. But because that's it, right? I think that the whole evil good thing, I never thought was a great addition to the game. I like having just the three alignments. I think it's just simpler, you know, and it also solves that problem where it's like people are like, well, you know, you can never steal if you're lawful or lawful good or whatever. You know, you would if you needed to, you know, it's like every action you do doesn't define, you know, alignment. That's a whole other podcast. But but I want to move that. But for instance, I do have anti-clerics or evil clerics, as it would be, which is the running joke and the thing going back to that story where they assassinated the evil cleric. You know, of course, I did the old thing all dungeon masters do. And just before they did it, I was like, so you're just going to kill this guy in his sleep? And one of the players was like, his title is evil high priest. Because that's like, because, you know, we use the titles from OD&D. And I was like, well, I can't deny that.
That's pretty awesome.
But so like I do things that, again, is how I interpret OD&D, which is there are reverse spells, like let's say darkness. That's for evil clerics. So good clerics can cast light. Evil clerics cast darkness. Good clerics can heal wounds. Evil clerics can cause wounds, right? So I've got this like cleric split that works just through the spell casting as far as that's concerned. One of the trickiest things with spell casting was spells that did damage, right? Because not strictly using hit points, I wanted to try to figure out how to, because I didn't want to use hit points for too many things. I wanted it to be special, right? Very, very few things use hit points. Like I said, Dragon's Breath Fireball uses hit points. There's a handful of other things that do, but most things just kill you or don't, you know, or put you to sleep or don't. So it's kind of like, so magic is really powerful, but limited.
Okay. Interesting. So when you say like clerics need a book, is this like a prayer book type of thing, or are there actual like full on books of spells kind of that were written by the clergy of this particular deity?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's basically a spell book, just like a magic user spell book. So it is a book of spells. It's not like what I do love how Hyperborea does it. I don't know if you've ever read how they do it, but it's basically they have like a prayer book. And the way he describes it is as they study their book, they find secrets in the book, and those secrets are the spells. I love that vision, but I just treat it as a straight up spell book right now because I wasn't trying to world build in the game at first. But again, I'm thinking about doing that because I love the idea that there's just this one god and that there's a lot of false clerics. And, you know, because again, it's more Conan-esque if you, and I talk about this actually a long time ago on the podcast, if you don't have these all-powerful gods, right? Where right. Like you go into a town and like they worship or this area, this, you know, maybe small city state, you know, it's like, I don't know, 5,000 people and they all worship this one god. But 200 miles away, that god has no power at all. Because right. They're just some demon, right? But the player characters can't have a god like that because that would make clerics just suck, you know? Mm-hmm. So basically, you need at least one, like, kind of all-powerful god. And in the world of Conan, that'd be like Mithra, right? It's like everywhere right. You go in there, everybody at least knows about Mithra. Whereas, like, Crom, like, people don't even know what Crom is unless you're from, you know, Chimeria. So that's kind of the way I look at it. So most of the, and all the, of course, all the evil clerics, are using these localized gods because the one god is not evil.
Interesting. So I guess that kind of goes into like what I was going to ask. So it sounds like you have a world, like you have a setting that you've been like playing in for quite a bit of time now, but you don't seem to be like wholly attached to, like, the system doesn't seem to be wholly attached to this world. Is that kind of what I'm getting at right now?
Yes, that's a very good sort of, yeah, I don't want, and this is actually a discussion I have a lot of time, this one and the Do I Need Thieves discussion, which I will talk about in a second, I guess, because that's always the discussion I bring up. I think to myself, I want to do this and I want to add my world because I think my world is really cool. And, you know, of course, I think my world is cool because I'm running it. And, hey, you know, and my players say it's cool, so I don't kill them with some kind of Balrog, you know. But, you know, I feel like part of the fun of the game for me is creating your own world. So when I buy a system, I don't necessarily want a fully fleshed out world. But I do like little bits and pieces, like, although Hyperborea is a bad example because that is a fleshed out world for the most part, although it's done in a really loose way. I don't know if you've read Hyperborea, but it's really well done where it's clear what the world's like, but like each area is like maybe two paragraphs. Like, and you get it. Like, if you've read enough Sword and Sorcery fiction, you get what's happening there. It's not these huge gazetteers of. So I think at the most I would do that. Like, I writing about how the clerics of Hastor, which is the god, operate. Is something I might put in there, right? But they're wholly separate from the rules right now, though. I guess you could call setting material like that, the fact that I have elves and dwarves and stuff and what they're like. But the other thing, too, that we have that's not actually in the supplement as it stands, because there is an alpha that people can download, is that the dwarves, and this is a great example of, I think, how my world building works, going all the ways back to the type of table I run. I ran a one shot, well, kind of a one shot, I think actually might even be online, of an adventure. And in that adventure, the elves had killed all the dwarves like 3,000 years ago. And that's what it was. So in this adventure, in this place, there's no dwarves, right? Because the elves are basically terrible. Like, they're like a militant power, and they're basically, and that was kind of just setting material. I was just talking about how terrible they were, that they literally eliminated the entire race of dwarves when they had the battle. They didn't just defeat them or whatever, they killed it, right? So when I started this campaign, one of my players who had been in that game said, oh, man, I'd like to play a dwarf, but the elves killed all the dwarves, right? Because things that we play in one game, they just kind of float into the next one. And then I was like, what if they really didn't, though? You know, I didn't go, no, this is a new campaign, right? I said, well, you know, I said, let's go along with your thought process. Maybe what would the dwarves do? Maybe that we started talking about, maybe they fled underground. So now the dwarves have been living underground for 3,000 years. So, you know, thinking about what would happen to something that lives wholly underground in the dark, we transformed dwarves into this kind of truly subterranean creature that is, they're completely pale. They have no hair. They're just, oh, they got lots of hair all over their whole body, but it's very small. They're totally blind. But they have kind of like enhanced, almost like Daredevil, but not quite like that, senses so that they can kind of see in the dark because they can smell, they can feel air currents, they can do whatever. So in the dark, they're totally fine, right? Out to 60 feet because that's kind of the range of, or if something's loud or whatever. They have great hearing, you know. Of course, they still have the normal dwarf abilities. They can sense sloping passages and stuff because you'd be able to do that, right? But they've been lost for all this time. So this one character is this dwarf who's now come to the surface, and what's on the surface but an open sky. They're effectively blind when they're outside. So this player has been playing the same character for like 2.5 years, and their character in a dungeon is just like amazing because nobody can see in the dark in OD&D except monsters. So they can see in the dark, which is like crazy. You don't realize how good being able to see in the dark is until you are the only thing that can see in the dark, right? Like in a lot of games, like even BX, where like, halflings don't have vision, but dwarves and elves both have it. You know, a lot of people play dwarves and elves, so it's like, you know, you're not really worried about the dark. So if it's dark, oh, a torch blew out, all right, well, the dwarves and elves will guard, we'll just light a new torch. In OD&D, nobody sees in the dark. So, but enemies can. So it's like you're always having to use a light source, so it's nearly impossible to sneak around. Now you have this character that can sneak around in the dark, right? And they can hear really well. But when they're like currently right now, they're over land and they're like on horses and stuff. They're basically having to be like tied to their horse because they can't see anything. So it's like you've created this, like it's world building, right? And this is what dwarves are in my world because this is what happened. And I don't have to have it that way in the system. right? But we love it. So I'll probably will do that, you know, because it's just so fun and so different, I think, than what other people do. The other thing I did was elves in OD&D have this weird rule that, which I might change, but we've been playing it this way, where they, in between adventures, you can switch from a fighter to a magic user or vice versa. Nobody else can really do that. You can do it once if you're a human. If you're a fighter and you want to be a magic user, you could switch if you're intelligence, high enough, whatever. Well, so why would they be like that? So I started thinking of Elfland and like, if you ever read The King of Elfland's Daughter, and it's like a real place you could go. And I'm like, what if an elf is only truly whole in Elfland? And when they cross the border, part of them stays back, either the warrior part or the magic user. So there's literally two parts to an elf. And so if they send their magic user part out and they like get killed, for instance, they would not be able to be brought back from the dead because they're still alive. Just only half of them is, you know? And so I started thinking that's kind of what's happening here. And so here's where a cool story ends up not really working well, because the way the system works, being an elf magic user is the way to be. Like, you would never want to be a fighter. Why bother? Because you can wear the armor and stuff. Well, you can't really wear the armor, but because you can't cast spells and armor, but you could use all the weapons and stuff. So the guy that plays the elf, he never went back and became a fighter, you know, because it didn't make sense. So I'm trying to figure out how to make that better. But I also don't want to make it so that it's not fun to play an elf, right? But like this idea of like that there's a second part of you somewhere else was really interesting. And the other thing I did with elves was I determined like, okay, so why can't clerics use edge weapons? And what we've come up with was magic swords are actually, they're all sentient in my world and they contain the souls of elves. So if you as an elf, once you are done with your adventuring career or whatever, or your life in Elfland, you can decide to become a sword. And you sacrifice your soul, and then the sword is brought into the world, and that's basically the sword. Now, it would be a sin, right, for the Hastor people to use it, because that's the soul of an elf, and it's like, that's, you know, that's against it. So they don't dare pick up a sword or a dagger or anything, because they're not sure that it doesn't have an elf soul in it. So it's really like, it's not that they can't use it, it's that they don't use it, because there's a real religious reason that's from the world. And of course, elves think they're crazy. Because elves are like, if you use a sword, it's like awesome, you know, but they won't use them. So now we have clerics that don't use swords, right, or any kind of edge weapon for that reason. And this is just a matter of like, instead of bumping off rules and saying they're stupid, it's a matter of digging into it and saying, why is that? And I know that no way was somebody sitting there in 1974 going, you know what we'll do with elves? Let's make them have two souls. I totally made that up. It has nothing to do. It's not at all what they were doing. I mean, if it is, I'm somehow crazily stumbled upon some unknown thing, but... And it doesn't matter that that's not what they were doing. It's me looking at these rules and going, hey, this seems pretty cool. So, yeah, that part's world building. Like, if I keep that in the game and I say the elves are like that, you know, that would be world building. But that's about as far as I'd go. Like, I'm not going to say there's a town over here called, you know, I say I can't go with names, but town name, you know, blank town, you know, and that I'm not that kind of a world builder.
Right. This sounds like super fascinating. Your world building is incredible. And I love how you're building off of the rules and sort of, you know, coming up with these explanations for why they're like that, instead of looking at it, which I think a lot of people probably do, as just purely mechanical. Like, that's just the way it is. That's the way Gary wrote it. That's the way it's gotta be, man. So talk to me about thieves.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and that's funny. I love you say that too, because that is so important to me, is that people, because I will get people a little bit, because I'll go to my solo play and they'll be like, well, you know, actually, I see them pushing their glasses up. And I'm just like, I am not playing this by the rules for whatever. This is my own, you know, whatever. I'm like, that's cool if that's, but guess what? No. So thieves, right? So there's no thieves in OD&D. And there is, of course, I think most people are joking when they say it, but I think there's probably some serious people that say thieves ruin the game, right? And people will be like, well, thieves ruin the game. And of course, when I first heard that, you know, I was like, what? These are my favorite class, right? A thief is the class that was my absolute favorite class I played in BX all the time. It didn't matter that they only had 10% chance to do things. It didn't matter that they had D4 hit points. I love playing a thief. I played them all the time. And I think thieves are wonderful. However, there's no thieves in, you know, OD&D. So how do you handle that, right? You could do, and I kind of do, basically what I think probably closer to maybe like what Matt Finch writes, you had him on. He was talking about this idea of like solving puzzles and, you know, for traps and stuff. And I think to a certain extent, that's what people probably did a bit. But I have a lot of a stronger feeling that most people, because this is what I did when I didn't have thieves in the game, immediately just went to things like roll under your decks. And quickly I found that that wasn't that interesting. You know, to me, I was just like, okay, so if you have a high dex, you could always do stuff. And if you don't, then you can't do anything, you know? So now I've got to like figure out, and I probably have a video about that. That's the greatest thing in the world to do. So opinions change, right? So at a certain point, I found this thing. I can't remember where I found it. It was actually an illustration. I don't even have it anymore. But I was looking for it the other day. It did not have the person's name on it because I wanted to actually use it when I first put the game together. It had like a sack and it said something like thieves tools. And it basically had, it was like a hand-drawn thing and it had like a little sack. And then next to it had like a wire saw. It had, a lock pick or whatever it had. Right? It had all these different things. It was just drawing. And I looked at it and I was like, yeah, right? Like, what makes you be able to pick a lock, easily is that you have lock picks, right? And theoretically, right, anybody could learn how to do that. And if we look at characters, going back to the fiction, they all do a lot of the stuff that's very thiefy. So if you're not going to take the thief and treat it a little more supernatural, which is how I do it in BX, which is a whole other conversation, but then maybe what makes the thief be able to do stuff is their stuff. So I just create a system where the gear is the ability. So if you want to hide in shadows, for instance, having a black hooded cloak helps you do that. Having, putting charcoal on your face or putting a mask on, wearing gloves will do that, right? Dulling any shiny stuff that you do. If you want to move silently, taking off your shoes will help you do that, or wearing soft boots instead of the hard boots that you have with armor, right? If you want to climb a wall, a grappling hook or a rope, obviously is going to help you, right? Or crampons, right? So basically, I broke down what I thought would be good for each thing, right? And the system is just as simple as this. If you want to do something that like that, let's say, for instance, you're going to hide in shadows. You hear guards coming down the hallway. There's nowhere for you to go. But it's this torchlight and stuff. So you're going to literally push yourself up against a wall between two torches with your cloak on, and you're just going to stand there as they walk by, right? That's hiding in shadows, right? Hiding in shadows is not getting behind something. Anybody can do that, right? But you're literally hiding in shadows. Well, roll 2d6. If you get a 12, you succeed, right? That's really hard, right? But the cloak gives you, I don't have it in front of me, +3, covering your face gives you +2, having gloves gives you +2. So all these things add up so that if you have all the right tools, your chance starts to get higher, closer to like 50% chance. And then additionally, depending on your levels, I think level 1 through 3, I think has no bonus, and 4 through 6 is +1. And I think 6 up is like +2. Different people, like halflings, get like +4, elves get a +. So when you start looking at it, you can actually get all these bonuses to make it much easier. But still, if you're just a regular fighter, human fighter, standing in the hallway in plate armor and they're coming down, you're just like, I'm going to die. I just go against the wall and win. And you roll that 2d6 and you get yourself a 12 because just somebody just wasn't looking and you just happened to, they walk right by you, because that's just the fate of the dice. And now you have that 2% chance just saved you. Is it likely? No. But if you're going to break into a place, that's what you do. You strip off your armor, right? You put on a black cloak. You put a dagger in your belt instead of a giant sword, right? You take off your shoes or put on lighter shoes. And that's what you do. Right? And what the funny part about this is, when we were kids, going back all the way back to that, I always thought it was funny as a kid. And I think it's funny now, actually, when I see it, when people are in town in like armor. Like even as kids, we knew, like, I wear plate or mail armor when I'm in the dungeon or even studded leather. I'm not wearing that when I go to the tavern. Like, that's not what you would do. You would put on regular clothes or maybe leather armor, right? Like, you wouldn't wear, because of course, we pictured leather armor as like a leather jacket or something, right? So you just wouldn't do that, right? Because you'd stand out. Like, you've got a giant two-handed sword and plate mail armor. You're at the bar at the tavern. Like, that'd be so weird, right? Because even thinking about like Westerns, right? Imagine a guy coming off the trail. And it's bad enough if you walk in with a 6-shooter on your side, but you walk in with 2, or you walk in with a rifle in your hand. I mean, people are going to be like, right? So that's kind of how we always played as kids. So this is kind of, it plays into this, right? The same thing when we were going to break into a place, we would think about it. We'd be like, well, we want to swim across the moat, so we got to take our armor off, right? I mean, that's just how you do it, right? So this game now, or the system, which is really just a tag onto the game, allows me to have this ability to make the equipment matter, right? So you can actually still hide if you're a fighter, still hide if you're a magic user. Some people are better at it than others because, you know, elves and dwarves and stuff, they're naturally stealthier halflings. But everybody can do it.
Interesting.
And then in the end, we don't need a thief, right? And every once in a while, I'll be sitting there at home and I'll be like, should I make a thief class? You know, and my girlfriend has to say to me, no, you don't need a thief. Because I just think like, yeah, that's the thing. I feel like people looking at this game are going to go, there's no thief. And they're going to have an issue with that. And I think in some ways, I'm happy for that. You know, like part of me, when you're creating a game system, going back to what I said earlier, because of course I was very bold, I said, I'm making this for me, because you are, right? But part of me is like, I'm making the system and I am having a lot of fun with my friends and I would love for people to play it. But every time I think of something that I think would make it more likely that people would play it, make it more like another system, it makes the system worse for me. Because why would I do that when that already exists? There's 1,000 D&D clones. There's 1,000 D20 games that say they're OSR games or whatever that are basically just 5e stripped down. There's 1,000,000 games that are just no rules at all and people just walk around rolling one die. This is different, you know? And I don't know, again, I'm not saying it's better or worse, but it's different. And I feel like I'm trying to keep the integrity of it. So that's why I don't have thieves, even though I am so tempted all the time to make a thief class.
No, that's very cool. Just to kind of like clarify, so when you say, because what you're describing really sounds like a skill system. So if you want to do other stuff, you look, the look on your face is sort of disagreeing with what I'm saying.
Okay, no, I like this. I'm seeing where you're going. Okay.
Because from what I'm understanding is that like essentially like if I want to try to hide in shadows, there's nothing class-wise that's restricting it. Essentially, as long as I'm doing the appropriate things, I'm wearing the appropriate, you know, gear to succeed at something, then I can I have a certain number of bonuses. I roll my dice and I either succeed or I fail. And then same thing, like if I want to pick a lock, right? Do I have the thieves tools? Do I have, you know, acid, depending on what kind of lock it is? Maybe I found like a skeleton key or I don't know, something, things to aid me in like, you know, picking that lock. It sounds like a skill system on some level.
Are you trying to say I'm a skill system guy?
No, I'm not. No,
revelations are happening. No, you're absolutely right. The way you describe it makes it sound like a skill system. Yes, this is a skill system. No, no, I was, you've just given me a revelation. I'd never thought of it like that, but yes, you're absolutely correct. This is basically a skill system. And you even get better at it, I guess, at level. So yes, this is a skill system. It's basically it's a skill. Good. There you go. It's a skill system. I'm looking at it now. It actually is called Adventurer Skills. So you are correct. It is a skill system. It was just funny because I'd never heard anybody say, oh, that's a skill system. Because I'm thinking to myself, well, skill system is like you put points in different things, but that's kind of what this is, except that you don't do it via character build. You do it via the world. So, yes, you're like my psychologist here, like revealing things into my brain that I've become a skill system person.
Dude, I feel honored that I contributed something positive to you.
I'm not saying it's positive. I'm just saying it happened.
So, I guess because kind of like one of the sort of things that I had encountered during my like experience with gaming, especially in the older school arena, was that your character tends to be more defined by the gear that you have. So, like, because you didn't have, because I really grew up in like the third edition era of D&D, right? So I was very much like, we got this class, you get these special abilities, you get more powerful as you go along. And it was really about, I guess, the way In Between Two Karens would describe it is like, it's fight D&D, right? It was just go around and kill shit and then take their stuff and do it all over again. Whereas like in older school D&D, it tended to be like, well, you don't have these special abilities to distinguish you and make you unique. There's no feats. There's nothing like that. You had skills, but even then those are really designated towards like the thief class or the rogues. But in older school, it's like, oh, well, I have this magic sword, right? It's my magic sword. It's special, right? Or I have this magic cloak. Or, you know, whatever the gear is that I have. And that's what gives me these special abilities to kind of do things and distinguish myself from like another fighter guy who's, you know, maybe he's got something cool. So when I hear you talking like that, I'm like, yeah, man, that makes sense that your equipment would be much more important. I almost think of like Shadowrun 2 or Cyberpunk, something where you know, you're getting modifications, body mods, buying different guns, different kinds of armor, stuff like that to basically make you more unique and capable in the sort of direction that you kind of imagine your character going in the fiction, right?
So No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it's just funny. I'm giving you a hard time because I never thought of it like that. I was like, skill system. No, I mean, it is. And what's nice about this is that I think, anyways, in practice, anyways, it's been flexible, you know, because again, you could say, well, so I use skeleton keys. I don't actually use lockpicks because I did a little bit of Googling. They didn't really, like, you wouldn't have lockpicks back the medieval. You'd have basically a bunch of weird keys and some would fit and some wouldn't. So you get these skeleton keys and they have a chance of working. Oh, but if you were like, I don't have a skeleton key, can I do it with a dagger? I mean, it'd be like, okay, well, I'll give you minus one chance, right? Because whatever. Like, I mean, you could do it. I mean, why not, right? Everything is... See, I think that's the difference. The reason why I created the system, really, was because it's almost a answer to the inevitable question of, can I do this because I have this? Which is what you're talking about, right? Which is what we encounter a lot. And I've actually talked about this a little bit before. It, my general philosophy about making rules is that if it's something that I have to do over and over and over again, I will make and write down the rule. Otherwise, I deal with it on a case-by-case basis, and I call that a ruling. Sometimes I will deal with it exactly the same way. Sometimes I won't because the situation is slightly different. But here, generally, I'm going to always locks are locks, right? I mean, there's going to be difficult locks, easy locks. You can modify that, but I have a base rule. Here's a rule for locks. Now, I could just say, look, there's a rule for opening doors in D&D, in OD&D. On a 1 or a 2, you open it. It says doors are stuck. What does that mean? It could be locked, could be bolted, could be swelled, could be any of that. I could just say, you open a door and a 1, I have a lockpick. Okay, fine. So instead of saying, yeah, which is kind of what I'm doing, with a skeleton key, you have a 1 or a 2 to open the door. So if I say the door is locked, then you could use the key to open it. If you don't have the key, which is the skeleton key, you could force it open, you open the same roll with the 1 or a 2. But if you do that, that's going to be noisy. Right. If you now here's another option. You use a knock spell. A knock spell is going to automatically work and be absolutely silent. So now you have three options as a player when you're looking at something. You have the key. If you want to spend the money to buy the keys, you can do it. If you want to just force the door, you can also do that. And if you have a spell, you can spend that second level spell to be 100%.
Interesting.
But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It is basically a skill system. And if you were doing other things, I did it for the basic skills of a thief. Because those are the ones where people that are used to other systems think of, right? Anybody who's playing an OD&D-ish type game has probably seen the basic thief skills, right? I mean, I know some games like White Box, Sword and Wizard has full-on skill, I think. But like White Box has just like thief skill, I think is what they call it. And they just say, list down underneath what they could be. But most things list them, right? Like move silently, hide in shadows, pick a lock, find a trap, whatever. So like by adding those things to... And I even say here, I'll tell you right here, I'll read for myself. Some skills require no tools and rely more on character skill and luck, such as searching for a trap or picking pockets sleight of hands. These tests can be adjudicated by the referee. So there's no skill for finding a trap. You adjudicate that based on what you're doing, right? There's no like, oh, I have the find trap item, because what would that even be? Like, what is a trap? Right. Well, right, but that might find what? A hollow in the floor? But what if there's holes in the wall that shoot arrows, right? So what is a find and trap device, right? So maybe the spider webs are actually wires. Like, you know, so I mean, again, yes, it is a 10-foot pole. But you know, that's what you would do. But I don't want to say you buy a 10-foot pole, you find a trap, because that is too general, right? Hiding is, I think, easy enough to say, well, no, there's no shadow here, you can't hide. Or you don't need to hide in shadows, you just go into the desk, right? But finding a trap is more general. I even think the same thing is true of sleight of hand or picking somebody's pocket. I don't love a skill for that because I think it depends on what you're doing. You know, like, how are you doing it? How are you going to pick up? Is somebody going to bump into them as you're pulling the stuff out of their pocket? Are you going to spill a drink on them? Are you going to do something to them first, get them drunk? You know, I mean, there's all different ways that pickpockets operate, right? Are you going to cut the strings on their purse as you go by? Are you going to grab it off of them and run like a purse snatcher and have somebody else get in their way and trip them? That's how you rob somebody, right? If you're a Yes, I was in another life, a hooligan from the...
You're a mind reader, I was thinking.
Yeah.
But, you know... It's funny that you say, like, talking about the 10-foot pole thing, because I was actually having this conversation recently with somebody, and that was my exact thing. I'm like, you never saw Indiana Jones with 10-foot pole, right? You never saw Conan with a 10-foot pole, which is sort of what the fiction is trying to emulate, is these cool characters doing cool stuff and sort of going like, oh shit, you see this moss? If you look under here, there's a pressure plate. Oh, you see those holes there? He probably got some poison spears or darts or something shooting out of there. You know, he approaches the statue with the little, you know, the little gold statue, and he's like, oh yeah, this is definitely a booby trap, you know? Even Goonies was full of that, right? So, like, I don't know, man. These are, to me, this is the classic sort of stuff. And whenever I see the 10-foot pole thing, I'm like, listen, if the 10-foot pole is what you're down with, then that's cool. But for me, that just makes my character feel a little less heroic. And I think especially, like, what you're talking about is, like, yeah, Conan's not walking around with a big stick. He's walking with a big sword.
Right. And again, and there's no reason why you couldn't use a spear. We quickly did that as kids. Like, we realized, well, why am I going to buy a 10-foot pole? I mean, they were cheaper. But, you know, I could just use my spear tip. You know, of course, obviously, you could break your spear by doing that. But the funny thing about the pole is I wonder, too, if that comes down to, you know, the fiction that people are consuming at the time that they get into playing or not. Because, like, to me, like, I immediately knew as a kid, like, nobody tells, there's no rule in BX that tells you what to do with a 10-foot pole. We all immediately bought one and knew what to do with it. You know, we're like, well, I mean, it's a, you can put it in front of you to make sure there's nothing there. You got to poke at things. Like, that's what you did when you walked around the woods as a kid with a stick. You know, you're poking at stuff before you go in there. Make sure there's no rattlesnakes are under the bush, you know, even though there's no rattlesnakes around front. But, you know, that's what you did when you were a kid, right? And I think that that's where the fiction takes over. And that's where it becomes trickier to create. So I'm getting more philosophical here about the system, right? Because when you sit at my table, let's say, for instance, I'm going to run, well, I'll run BX2 or whatever, but I'm going to run my game the way I run it. But there is almost no way that I can bottle that. You know, as much as I can put into the rules explaining how I might do something, you have to look at that and go, oh, yeah, I get that. You know, because I can totally see. And in fact, I've seen people take this, and I'm not going to call anybody out because I did not, when I saw it, say anything. I've seen people take this playtest and actually run it and take parts from it and do it in the way that I did not intend. And when I saw that, I was like, cool. They look like they were having fun. If that's the way they're doing it, you know, now if they did it and were like, this is dumb, it doesn't work, then I might say, hey, this is what I meant here. What would have made it more clear to you is that, but if you're playing it and you're just like, hey, this is how I see the roles because this is what you wrote and this is what I get from it, then I'm not going to tell you you're doing it wrong. Because I'm sure that on some level, we're all doing something wrong in some of these systems, you know?
Well, this has been a really fascinating conversation. I feel like we've been talking for a good little while now.
I do that.
Nah, dude, this has been amazing. And I feel like I've really learned a lot from you just in this little conversation. I mean, I'm always surprised about it's always those little tidbits, the little things where I'm like, wow, you know, like I never considered it that way. And I really like your style and your approach. And this game sounds super fascinating. So I'm going to get the link from you and put it into the show notes so that other people can hopefully get a chance to like download it and take a look at it. And yeah, because I mean, I want to read it myself because I love this. This sounds so cool. Like I've been running Shadow Dark because it's been the closest thing to like what my style has been so far. But even then, I'm not 100% satisfied with a lot of things. And I've been thinking about making adjustments. But when I hear you talk, because I've always wanted to do the more heroic kind of older school style of play. And I was a little saddened when I interviewed Matt Finch and he was like, well, maybe you should play like Savage Worlds, which is fine. Like I want to play Savage Worlds. I'm playing it now. We're playing Deadlands. But yeah, it's like, no, dude, I want to play your game, man. And it kind of feels it's a bad feel when you're kind of like the guy is saying, well, you know, and I mean, super nice dude. I don't think I think Matt wants you to play the game any way you want to play the game. But I think, I don't know if the rules of Swords and Wizardry necessarily align with the sort of like idea that I had in my head of, you know, like you said, to do the Conan the way you've kind of like thought about it, right?
Yeah, I think what you'd have to do, and again, it would not be perfect with D&D to do this. And I have actually done this. is, so there's a couple of things. This is just general tips if people don't want to change the game they're playing and they want to. Number one, you can't play low level. I mean, that should be obvious, right? Conan's not first level. Even Conan's First Adventure, which I think is arguably Tower of the Elephant, but it might be Frost Giant's Daughter, if you count that as an official Conan story, but people can call in, I guess. Conan's devastating. Like, he's a killer. He's tougher than, you know, anybody else. And he starts off as a hero, right? He's already fourth, fifth level. So I think if you're going to try to play that, you got to do that. And more important than that, and more important than anything, and I think Borre does this really well. It just is a baseline, and there are modules. Wow, really pitching Hype Borre today. You're welcome, Jeff. No, it's a great game. They do what D&D didn't do, and they should have, in my opinion, AD&D. If you pick up an AD&D module, and I sometimes joke about this, you go into the tavern, the waitress is a 15th level, I'm exaggerating, it's like a third level of thief. The bartender is, you know, a fifth level ranger. There's a paladin, like, washing dishes in the back. It's like, and they're like, well, adventurers have to retire somewhere, but it's like, how are the characters supposed to be heroes when everybody in this adventure is third level? And I know that they did this. I mean, I suspect that they did this based on things I've read, because there was a problem with players, let's just say it, and a pretty common thing called murder hoboism, of like, the players just come into town and kill everybody. So they were like, well, let's make modules where everybody's tough. That'll teach them. I'm not a fan of that style. I think that the world can catch up to people, and I think that you can get somebody on your butt if you do that. But what Hyperborea does really well, and what I like to do in my world, is the vast majority of people are zero level. Like, most people are not adventurers. Even your guards are like not even true fighters. They're like one hit die, like not even the 1+1, right? They're regular men, or whatever they used to call them in the game. That is most of the people you should not be running into. Every person you encounter should not be your level or higher. If you want the characters to feel heroic, if you start a campaign and everybody's starting fourth level, and you have almost everybody they encounter be zero level or first level, and then like the captain of the guard be like their level, they'll feel powerful, right? Because of the thing with hit points and other things, I think that you have a hard time maintaining that in a lot of old school games, because healing takes so long. And I get that's part of the campaign, but I also feel like, and I'm saying if you're modifying your game, that's a good solution, I think. It's just, I don't know how high Shadow Dark Goats, how that would modify. I haven't actually played. I did the PDF because I thought the art was really good, but I've never played it. Seems pretty nice. I mean, people play it a lot. Seems to be a popular game right now. I have yet to try it, so no opinion from me. I love Swords and Wizardry, though. I will say that. But I did accept it for what it was. You know, it's like, okay, you're first level, you know, an orc's going to kill you with one hit if you're not lucky. So you got to be clever, right? It's a game of being clever, not as much a game of being heroic, you know, I think at that point. So, yeah, I think that you could, you know, you might enjoy this. I mean, you know, we should get a game together. You know, you could try it. It's really fun, I think, and it's really easy. You know, I often feel like people get nervous trying a new game, but I've run it at conventions for the last few years, and I've had some repeat people. Just about everybody who sits on the table has never played before, and they get it. It's not hard, you know. And it feels darn good when you. Just one quick story before we go, because just to give you an idea. So going back to the dwarf thing, one of my players, they suspected this guy was going to try to screw them over, which I don't usually do. So, but they suspected this guy. And he was escaping through a secret door, and they're like, I'm going to follow him. And it was a dwarf player. And I'm like, well, he goes and it's dark, you know, because this guy knows where he's going, right? He puts his hand on the wall. He's good. So I'm like, you can see he's got his hand on the wall. He's going down there. He goes down these twisting tunnels, and they're like, they're by themselves. So like, I'm going to follow him. So he goes down, opens up into a larger space. Again, he thinks he's in the dark, right? He doesn't know about dwarves. Dwarves have been dead for 3,000 years. He steps in there. He's got 12 guys in there, 12 orcs, I guess it would be. So he kind of goes to the side of the room, gets against the wall, and he goes, attack! The player can see. They're a six-level fighter. The orcs move forward. In one round, the orcs are dead, right? So for various reasons. And it was just awesome because, like, I'm thinking, yes, this moment is why I designed this game. Because you couldn't do this in any version of D&D I've ever played. Not if you played it the way that the game was written. Not 5e, where it's more heroic. Not 1e, not OD&D, not basic. Because of the nature of the hero and being defended with the hit dice, because of the extra stuff I added, which I didn't really talk about, the hero combat, fighters become very powerful. So if you want to do that. But if you are not into that, if you're like, no, 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 I'm all about old school, the way they used to play it, this is not for you, because this is definitely a different scale of game. But if you're interested, I think it's worth looking at, you know, at least to pull some things from.
No, this sounds super awesome. And I'm definitely going to have to get, I don't know what it is, but like, I've been getting the Hyperborea from like everywhere. Everyone's like Hyperborea, Hyperborea. So like, I'm going to have to get Hyperborea now and check that out too. Cause it does, it sounds like it scratches a lot of itches that I have too, but yeah, if the opportunity comes up, I would definitely love to get in a game with you and, you know, try this out firsthand. And, I feel like my players, like one of the things that I find so amazing is I have what I call my youth group. So that's my kids, and they're like in their 20s. And then I've got my regular group that are a little bit older. And then my ladies group that are about the same age. And I find I expected to get a lot of resistance from the younger crowd to be like, yeah, we don't want to really play this. Like, we want to do more heroic, more cinematic type of stuff. And they're really cool with the low powered stuff. But at the same time, like, I used a house rule when I first started with Old School Essentials, where like the fighter, if you got a hit, and I think if you killed the guy, then you could attack the next guy. And they've been bugging me. They've been bugging me to use it in Shadow Dark too. And I'm like, yeah, I hear you. It's cool. But I'm not really sure I want to mess around with like homebrewing too much stuff in Shadow Dark right now until I have a better feel for it. But yeah, these guys are just super down with this older school mentality. And it surprises me because, you know, like when I first started playing in third edition, so like 2001-ish, I kind of came in at the tail end of second edition, and then really third edition was when I started playing. Mm-hmm. And I kind of felt like, well, why would you play these older editions of the game? Right. Like, they made a new edition because there was something wrong with the old edition. And so now they're making improvements to the new game. Right. And really, I don't believe that anymore. Right. Like, it's like every game sort of had its own unique sort of thing to it. And there was nothing necessarily broken or wrong with these games. It was just that, you know, kind of ideas changed or design goals changed. You know, people were trying out new things, but there's still a whole lot of good game that's there. So it's cool to, and I think there's definitely this tradition that you're carrying on with the hackability of these games, right? Mm-hmm. It feels like people who play these games really want to like make them their own and customize them. And I think that's like, it's fantastic how you've been doing this. And I really like the approach of the combination between the mechanics of the game. And then also, like you said, the world building part of it too, right? Like, you really like have really woven the two together in a really nice way. So thank you so much for coming on, Daniel. I really appreciate it. It's been fantastic, man.
Yeah, it was super fun. I always like talking about stuff. It's just funny, I never talk about, because I don't do the podcast anymore. I'm like, oh, you know, it might be fun to talk about, because I'm just playing it. And then, you know, I'll get emails and I'll get like things in my Discord. People will be like, when's the next version of the cover? And I'm like, it's kind of written in like the history of my gaming table. I just haven't typed it into the, you know, because I need to make it so it's a full game. Because right now it's listed. I say it to me, it's a supplement for OD&D. You do need OD&D to play it. You don't really need chainmail to play it, but you need OD&D for sure. It can't hurt to read chainmail, but you don't need it. Because everything from chainmail that I wanted, I put into the game.
Is it really like you need OD&D, or can you use it with Swords and Wizardry?
I mean, you could use it with Swords and Wizardry.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody else could.
Okay.
But I have faith that you could do it. Well, just what I mean by that is, like, for instance, if you go to the spells, that would be the biggest place. Like, for I'm looking for a spell. Like, it'll say something like, what's listed here is literally the page it's on. And same thing with some of the monsters. So you need the book for that reason. So you, you kind of do need it. But that being said, you need a version of it. So yes, Swords and Wizardry would be fine as well.
Is it is OD&D available on the Dungeon Master's Guild?
Yeah. 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 I think it's either $5 or $10.
Okay. Cool, man.
But the three little brown books. You yeah, so I'm looking at the magic user spells. Like again, you tell me if you could do this. Hit the first level spell, detect magic. Mm. It just has the page. But you tell me, what does a detect magic spell do? There's a test here.
I mean, to me, it detects the presence or not presence of magic. So I guess.
Oh my God, are you amazing? I can't believe it. Well done. I know, it's very funny though. I'm joking, but when I do this at conventions, and only once, this is why I have to tell the story. Only once I've ever had a pushback on this. In conventions, I give people character sheets with magic users and they just have the spells listed. And I say, the spells do exactly what you think they do. Mm. If you have a mechanical question though, let me know. And I've never got anybody ask me any question, except maybe like in the middle of the game, we're like, would a fireball do this? The one person that had a question that needed to know what every spell did line by line, Kara King of D&D Homebrew. He's like, I see I have this spell here. What's the range of, I'm like, take the book.
That is hilarious. Now it's weird, right? Because I remember playing when we played third edition and we cast Detect Magic, that spell is like the list. It's huge. It's a huge block of text. And it's like, oh, you got to like face this direction. And then you're kind of like you're like, boop, 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 boop. And I'm just like, oh my God, man. I'm like, why is it so complicated? Like, so.
Well, you know why? It's because people argue. And I think that, again, that's where it comes down to like a game like that. And I want to leave it like this. So again, it's not going to be for everybody for this reason. I feel like I'm talking about to play, but you know, I'm not going to say detect magic. You face a certain way. I think the original text from OD&D says something like detects the presence of magic or enchanted things. It's like a range. It's like close by. Duration is like not very long. It's something like that. So there's always that question of like, well, how long? And what's funny about it is it's not every spell is not like that, because I thought that detect invisible was like that too, because one of the characters had it on their sword. And I was like, well, it's just going to be not very long and the close by. And then they had the book and they're like, oh, actually, no, look at it. It's like a range of 12 inches and, you know, 1 hour or something. I'm like, oh, all right, well, there you go. 12 inches, 1 hour, you know? So, yeah. So like spells, like I just like knock continual light, ESP. I don't write them out. Ones that mechanically need information, I have written out. So, yes, you could 100% use a different system, you know, and as long or just, you know, again, most of the spells, you know. Like, for instance, I added, because OD&D does not say that, for charm person, asking the charm victim to act completely out of their nature will trigger a new saving throw. You know, so OD&D does not say that. Basically, it says the unfortunate person is under your influence. Like, that's the spell. And duration is permanent until dispelled. I do this because I feel like in the fiction, people do things that are terrible, like kill their... You know, the trusted guard kills the king, right? That does happen under charm spells, but people also break spells. So I figured this is a good thing. They get another save. So like a regular person needs a 10 on 2d6 to save. So if you charm some servant in a castle, you know, chances are you can tell them to poison the king and they'll do it. So, I mean, it is still powerful, but if you charm, you know, the greatest wizard in the land to get lucky with the roll, you know, and then go cast Meteor Storm and destroy the village, you know, they'll probably get another save and you're going to be in trouble at that point. and again, before I did that, by the way, I actually more or less, maybe not the exact example, said that to the table. I was like, look, we got to work out charm person, because they have all played, like a couple of my players, they started with Pathfinder. They've all played 5e. We've played all different games. So they played more, you know, in-depth games and less in-depth games. And I said, what do you think? How does this sound? You know, like the other day, like somebody, they charmed this guy and then they're like, oh, pretend like you're a prisoner, you know, so that we can get past these people. He did it, but then the people grabbed him and beat the crap out of him. And the players let them because they didn't want to start a fight. So I'm like, well, he's going to get another role for that. Because like, basically, I mean, think about it, like logically, he should get another role. And nobody had an issue with that. In fact, what they did later on was they were like, he probably got another save. I'm going to sneak up over here and cast Detect Magic and look over at him and see if he's still under a charm spell. And I'm like, no, he's not. So they were like, oh, okay, we got to watch out. This guy's not charmed anymore. You know, and you know, you got a feel for it. But yeah, you could definitely do it. You just have to, you know, be kind of got to finesse it a little bit. But I think, yeah, I don't think it's that hard. If your system has those spells, which most OD&D-ish, those sorts of ones are going to be a good example, do, you should be able to make it work.
Nice. All right, Daniel. Well, thank you for plunging the dungeon with me.
Anytime.
I will have, again, as I said, the links to your shows in the show notes. And till we meet again next time, plungers up, everyone.
That's all for this week, folks. Music and stingers by Reed Reimer of Fable Factory Studio. Cover art by John McNally. And a special thanks to Edward Vallee, the voice of Hector.
Greetings, listener. It is I, Hector, the real Dungeon Plunger. Not that linguine-ons Jason. If you want to hear more interviews like this one, follow us and share this podcast with your friends, your family, your neighbors, random strangers, the people living in the wall, the troll that lives under the bridge, the guardian of the lost city, everyone! It means the world to us that you share our podcast and make our numbers bigger. Plungers up!
And remember, when you're plunging in the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets. They're a pain in the butt.